One size fits all seems like a good idea for clothes until you try them on. Same goes for healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hello, you're listening to The Future of Media Explained with me, Press Gazette Editor-in-Chief Dominic Ponsford. This week's episode is all about subscription strategies, and we're talking to Atlantic CEO Nicholas Thompson. So joining me on the Future of Media Explained podcast sofa is Press Gazette UK editor Charlotte Tobit. Hi, Charlotte.
Hello, Dom.
And so, we've spoken to probably one of the fittest CEOs, Nicholas Thompson. I don't mean he's attractive, although, you know, I'll let others be the judge of that. But remember the last time we interviewed him, we said he's like an extremely successful runner.
There is a mention of that in this interview. He's now writing a book about running.
Yeah, but he's been running a good race since 2022 when we last met him, because I think back then he was talking about subscriptions and then they were at 750,000. Where are they at now?
So the reason we're speaking to Nicholas is they've just had kind of a dual milestone of two massive targets that they had set. So they've reached 1 million subscriptions and they've also announced that they've become profitable.
That's trebles all round, as they say. That's fantastic news, isn't it? Before we get into Nicholas, what do we know about The Atlantic? Our start. They're old, aren't they? By anyone's standards, by American standards, they're ancient. They're 167 years old. They're a bit like, I think they're probably a bit like the New Statesman or Prospect, something like that in the UK, in the sense they're a sort of slightly left, lean back, look at the news. They're away from the sort of daily, weekly hurly-burly to give you a bit of a more thoughtful view on things. Is that fair?
Yeah, it's kind of fewer but thought-provoking reads. I mean, I'd say every week or certainly every month there's like one big Atlantic story across all my timelines that everyone's talking about. So they're going for that rather than trying to cover everything.
And they're sort of privately owned, aren't they, by a squillionaire owner? Is that right?
Yeah, so a few years ago, the Emerson Collective, which was co-founded by Laureen Powell Jobs, the widow of Apple co-founder Steve Jobs, took a majority share, so that's since 2017.
They've got a few quid behind them, but they don't have to worry about that so much now because they're actually profitable. So it's sort of an amazing story, isn't it? Like 1 million subs, profitable. I think you said they've got, over $100 million in revenue?
Almost, yeah. What we should mention is that it's not always been a dead cert. So 4 years ago, May 2020, they laid off about 17% of staff, so about 68 people, citing the impact of COVID on in-person events and advertising. And, you know, they've had lots of years in the red, very much not profitable. So this is a really significant moment, a kind of turnaround for them.
And now they're around two-thirds reader revenue, I think you said.
Yeah.
So yeah, you can see how that puts them in a much more comfortable position. So if you've got two-thirds reasonably reliable revenue, then the one-third can be made up of, events, advertising. You can see how that's a much more stable business now. But yeah, like you say, wasn't a dead cert, but it's a success story in a year which has been not overflowing with news media success stories. I think it's fair to say that the people on the reader revenue side of things have been doing a lot better than the people on the ad-funded journalism on the open web side of things.
Yeah, like in the UK, for example, all the recent company accounts that we've been looking at, The Times has been one of the strongest ones, I'd say, compared to The Mail Group, The Sun, the Times is the title. You know, those ones are probably slightly tougher year than the Times, and that's down to the subscribers.
Well, look, brilliant. Let's hear from Nicholas. Let's hear how he does it. He's got it in profit. Subscriptions, print and digital, are both doing really well. Lead us into the interview, Charlotte.
Brilliant. So, yes, Nicholas just starts by summarising where they're at as a business.
The business is going well, knock on wood. As you mentioned, we've become profitable after being pretty deep in the red for a long time. We've reached 1 million subscribers, and we're seeing growth in all the major revenue parts of our business while keeping costs under control. So things look pretty good right now, but I've been in journalism long enough to know that that's not a guarantee for tomorrow.
Definitely. I mean, a big question is, it sounds like a great kind of point on your journey, but as I mentioned, a lot of media companies have had a tough year with particular types of advertising, downturn, kind of rising costs, declining search and social referrals. So why do you think you've managed to do it now when other people are, or not everyone, but, you know, some people are struggling a bit?
Well, we do have many of the same issues that other publishers do. We also have seen a decline in referrals from Facebook and Google as they have deprioritized news. We also have seen complexity because of that in our programmatic advertising business. But what's made our particular business resilient is that the majority of our revenue comes from subscriptions, and we've become better at selling subscriptions. We've become better at pricing subscriptions, and our editorial model is particularly aligned to a subscription business model. So our editorial model is to publish not nearly as many stories as many of our peers, but to every now and then, as best as we can, publish stories that lots and lots of people talk about. And those tend to increase brand perceptions. They tend to drive a lot of subscriptions. And right now, the confluence of all the math behind the way our subscription engine works and our editorial strategy, along with a successful advertising strategy, which has overall become more and more successful over the last year and a half or so, it's put together a pretty great result.
So you currently had a target of reaching 1 million by the end of this year, didn't you? So kind of what's next? Are you going to set new targets, or where do you go with that journey now?
Yeah, one of the things that I liked is we set dual targets of profitability and reaching 1 million subscribers. And the reason to do that is that you can reach 1 million subscribers, you can reach whatever subscriber number you want if you're willing to take on losses, right? You can just use paid marketing to drive subscribers, or you can reduce your prices massively. And so if your only goal is increasing the number of subscribers, you can create some perverse incentives for your overall business. If your only goal is profitability, well, then you could try to get there by becoming smaller and doing fewer stories more efficiently and, you know, relying more on your archives or however you want to do it. But the nice thing about having these two goals is that it meant that the way to get there was by getting bigger, by being smart, and, you know, by being sensible about how we increase subscriptions. So now we have to choose the next set of goals, and we haven't decided on them yet. There are a lot of things under consideration. You could imagine that, you know, let's try to get to 1.5 million subscribers. Let's try to be profitable for 3 consecutive years. Or you could imagine something like, you know, we could come up with an entirely different set of goals based on the demographics of our readers or the number of stories. So we are debating, negotiating, figuring it out. I'm pretty confident that we'll come up with some goals, but it's pretty hard to find exactly the right goal for your organization at a given moment.
Yeah, because you don't want to just do something for the sake of it, do you?
No, and every goal that you create, and this is something I've learned at all the organizations I've worked at, if you create a goal and you properly incentivize people and you talk about it, you will create weird behaviors that you didn't expect, and you will end up with some strange outcomes. So, you know, I've worked in places where the consumer revenue side has had an incentive for total number of subscriptions, but has had no incentives on revenue. And that has led to extreme discounting, right? So what you want to do is you want to figure out a goal that really works with the spirit of the organization.
So instead of discounting, obviously, have you found new strategies in terms of like subscriber acquisition, but crucially retention? Like, have you been doing new things to keep churn down?
Definitely. So we work very hard to try to keep churn down, and we study what the churn rates are of people coming in from different referral sources. Right. So what is the, you know, if somebody comes in through paid marketing on Facebook, what are the odds that they churn? What are the odds that they don't churn? If somebody signs up for a trial subscription, what are the odds that they churn? If they sign up for what we call a same day start, meaning they just subscribe right at the moment, what are the odds that they churn? So we study those numbers very carefully, and then we try to study the behaviors that make churn less likely. Right? Obviously, if they sign up for newsletters, they're less likely to churn. If they're even aware of our subscriber-only newsletter program, they're less likely to churn. If they join the app, if they read more, if they follow us on social media. And so one of the things we try to do at The Atlantic, and this is, I think, a good lesson for a lot of things in life, is there are always 100 things or 1,000 things that you could do to be better at whatever you're trying to be better at. And the challenge isn't to find the one that would bring the most improvement. It's to find the one where the minimal amount of effort will bring the max improvement, right? So you can limit the number of ones that you do. And so we're often going through, you know, what we call the highest leverage options. And so we look, okay, so should we try to get more people into our app? Should we try to make the product selection page load more quickly? Should we run more tests on our pricing model? And there are all these different things you can do. And so we're constantly trying to evaluate what is the next thing we can do that we think will give us the most leverage in reaching the targets we want to reach. And so with retention, we identified that, somewhat to my surprise, people who subscribe out of trials are much less likely to retain as subscribers after a year as people who subscribe on the same day start. The reason that surprised me is I would have thought, actually, if you subscribe in a trial and then you keep your subscription, you've actually committed to The Atlantic twice. You've signed up for the trial and then you've kept it. I would have thought that after a year, you'd be equally likely. It turns out that's not the case. It turns out that for whatever confluence of reasons, if you sign up for a trial, even if you keep your subscription active, after a year, you are like, I don't know, maybe it's 7-8% more likely to churn. And so you can then, we identify that as a major problem or major issue. So then the question is, okay, do we try to think of things that we can push trial subscribers to do that make them particularly likely to not churn? Or should we try to figure out ways to increase the percentage of people who come in through what we call same-day starts? And so we've been working on both ends of that particular problem. And I don't know exactly what the answer is. We're testing a lot of stuff right now. But it's through tests and experimentations like that that we've kept churn pretty consistent. I think it's almost exactly at the same level as it was. Maybe it's a little bit worse than it was a year ago. But in that year, you know, we've increased prices, we've tightened our paywall, we've done a whole bunch of things that you would think increase churn. And so keeping it steady is a victory.
That's super interesting. Thank you. And how tight is the paywall now?
Well, it changes all the time, but it's pretty tight. You know, we run a lot of experiments on, you know, should people be able to read 4 stories, 3 stories, 2 stories, 1 story? What about people who are coming in from social media? What about people who are coming in from Google? So we have a whole algorithm. We're running tests all the time. But some people hit the paywall immediately. Some people are able to read stories, but it's fairly tight.
And while we're on the subject of paywalls, I wanted to bring up kind of the philosophical side of it, I suppose. So interestingly, last week, you at The Atlantic had a piece about kind of democracy dies behind paywalls. And I saw it being shared a bit about kind of the irony of that being behind a paywall. But obviously, the argument was that maybe it shouldn't be during like the election run up and things like that. But obviously, lots of publishers believe very strongly that journalism should be paid for and all of that. And so with that context of you publishing that piece, I wondered how you would respond to that.
Well, you know, one of the great things about The Atlantic is we publish a wide variety of views. You know, we are a collective of writers who have often disagreed with each other. You know, Jeff Goldberg, the editor-in-chief, had a wonderful quote in the Wall Street Journal where he said that even he doesn't agree with everything The Atlantic publishes. So we are happy to put out different articles with different viewpoints as long as they're well-argued, well-reasoned, beautifully written. This particular argument, as you can imagine, is not one that has completely persuaded me. You know, my view is I have a very specific role here, which is to make sure that The Atlantic is in good financial state and that when I leave this job, It has its future insured for as long as we can see out over the horizon. I want the Atlantic to be sustainable. I'm not trying to maximize profits. I'm trying to make it sustainable. I would be delighted to have us have small profits into the infinite future. My ideal state for the Atlantic would be for it to continue to grow and to be, you know, sustainable, slightly profitable over the long, 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 long run, right? That's what I'm trying to get to. And I believe that one can do that most efficiently through paywalls. And so the argument that you should not have a subscription and you should open it all up and more people can read, well, if the cost is the future of the Atlantic, this publication that was founded in 1857 by abolitionists to stop the American Civil War, that's not a trade-off I'll take. So now that said, there are lots of things we do to make sure our stories spread. Right? If there is a story that we believe is highly in the public interest, there's information in this story that will help you deal with the COVID crisis right now, that will help you prevent a bad thing in the moment, we, of course, make that totally open. There's no, we lift the paywall. There's a button that our CTO can press and poof, no paywall. We also, you know, distribute our stories. You know, not all our stories, but some of our stories on syndication platforms where there's no paywall, right? We also offer access without paywalls to universities and college students that sign up with us. So young people have access to it. So, and then of course, you know, the ideas in our stories, our writers are going off on TV, they're going out on radio. So our ideas get disseminated quite a bit. I don't think there is a shortage of conversation in the world about Atlantic stories, even though I'm always trying to maximize it. So I could see where the author, Rick Stengel, was coming from. He's a good writer. He's a smart person. But, you know, as Jeff said, don't always agree with everything we publish.
I think that's very healthy. So, are you able to share the numbers of the split between like digital only versus like digital and print subscribers?
Well, we don't, I mean, yes. Yeah, so I think we have, it's something like, I mean, everybody who's a print subscriber has digital access, and it's somewhere around a little bit under 500,000 people get the print publication. So it's about half.
Okay. That's interesting. And, is it still mostly US? How kind of international are you now?
It's still mostly US. I believe our web audience is about 15% international. Not 100% certain on that, but it's right around there. I don't know about our print circulation. I would imagine it's a little bit lower than that, but we are mostly United States based. But after this podcast, all over the UK.
So, you touched on earlier the advertising side as well. So how big or small is that compared to subscriptions nowadays?
Our advertising side, it depends on whether you look at, depends on exactly how you're looking at the P&L, but you know, it's going to be, it's less than half. It's probably, you know, trending towards a third. But what we also look at is profitability. And so our goal for the advertising side is to not maximize revenue, but to maximize profitability. You sell an ad for $3. And it costs you $1 to make the content for the ad and to sell it and all that. That is better than selling an ad for $4 that costs you $3 to produce and sell. So we have been trying to, one of the challenges in our business has been to identify which ads have the best margins, which kinds of selling have the best margins. It's not a simple equation because there's, you know, many, many factors that go into this, but we have tried very hard to increase the profitability of that business, and we have done so. And we're kind of on an advertising roll. We have a Slack channel devoted to, you know, which advertisements that come in, and it's always lit up.
So what type of like you mentioned about, you know, you've been hit with programmatic difficulties like lots of people. So what type of advertising is working well for you?
Yeah, so a whole bunch of different kinds of advertising. So we have a whole, you know, print advertisements are wonderful. A lot of luxury advertisers are, you know, they want the ad in the back page of the print magazine. Obviously, that is a small revenue line, but they are profitable. Great. They're wonderful. They make the print magazine look better. Love those ads. We have a number of large brand partners who will hire us to do content for them. So we have a branded content studio that is very efficient, very good. They make podcasts, right? They made a great podcast last year for Hauser & Wirth. They made a great magazine last year for Google. Google wanted a magazine about big questions in AI. So we put that together for them, right? So we are assigned a lot of editorial projects. We're doing a series of videos right now for Microsoft. So we have big advertisers who do branded content campaigns. We also, of course, have direct sold ads on our website, whether it's homepage takeovers, whether it's just run of site ads. We run those. They have a higher CPM. The programmatic ads. Obviously, we like to run all of those. We're seeing a lot of growth in the auto industry. We're seeing a lot of growth in the entertainment industry. And of course, we're seeing lots of success in the tech industry.
Perfect. That is probably reassuring to lots of people as well. And are there any other kind of major revenue areas we should mention? I think events?
Yeah, so we count events. We roll events into our advertising business, and that has been growing and has been successful. We look at them as, you know, trying to maximize profitability and margins, but also have editorially excellent events that are good for our brand, good extensions, good ways for our writers to meet people, good ways for people to be introduced to the brand. So we have a very strong event strategy that, you know, we will do small events. We will host dinners, host private conversations. We'll host single topic events. And then, of course, we have our flagship event in September in Washington, D.C. Everybody should travel and come, called the Atlantic Festival, where the biggest names in Washington and around politics, entertainment, culture come and talk to our writers and editors, which is a wonderful, wonderful thing. So that is a major line. Beyond that, you know, when I came into this job, you know, I thought that one of my first tasks would be find a third revenue stream, right? Like maybe when I had been the editor in chief of Wired, and we had a lot of success in affiliate revenue, but that doesn't really work for the Atlantic. We haven't found a strong third revenue stream. We're very dependent on advertising and subscriptions. I would love to find one. We've tested a number of things, but they're all rounding errors on the P&L.
So obviously they're very different businesses, but why in particular does affiliates not work for the Atlantic?
Well, the only area where the Atlantic's content naturally fits with affiliate revenue, there are a couple, is book reviews. And then a second would be, you know, film reviews, TV reviews. Then you could click and, you know, rent the film on Netflix. And so we built an affiliate module on our book reviews. And it's fine, right? It generates more revenue than we'd get if we didn't. But people don't really, they don't think of the Atlantic as a place that's guiding commerce. There's that brand association the way there was at Wired, for example. People don't buy as many books. They certainly don't spend as much money buying books as they do buying televisions or, you know, buying headphones and iPads and Kindles and all the other things we did at Wired. You know, it's a relatively small category with relatively small revenue, and so you're getting relatively small commissions, and it just doesn't really add up. You know, we also have an IP business where we, you know, license the content that we create in the magazine or on the website. We work with creative agents in Hollywood to sell it to studios. That is a good business, but it's a hits business, and, you know, Hollywood's been on strike, and there's all kinds of other complexities. So that's gone fine. But it's not a major revenue source for us either. And then, you know, we're looking at a whole bunch of other things.
Hi, I'm Anoush, and I host the New Statesman podcast. Twice a week, we get under the skin of Westminster to help understand what's going on and what's going to happen next. We interview politicians, policymakers, and people on the front line to get you the full story behind the headlines. Plus, hear from our award-winning editorial team, including political editor Andrew Marr, to get to the bottom of what on earth is happening. Listen to the New Statesman podcast. You can subscribe now wherever you get your podcasts.
So I already alluded to it once, but obviously you've got a major election in the US coming up this year. Last time Donald Trump won, there was kind of this Trump bump idea and subscription publishing businesses. What are you thinking as you look ahead to the election and the potential winner? Like, are you seeing it being very useful for the Atlantic? What are your thoughts?
Well, I mean, a couple of things. So number one, I don't think there's going to be the same traffic boom for Trump coverage as there was during the last election cycle. You know, we've seen that our coverage of Trump, and I think coverage at other publications, you know, matches this, that the spikes that people saw in 2016 and 2020 are less likely to come. You know, people will be very interested in this election. It will be a huge international news story. There will be a winner. There will be a loser. There will be dramatic moments. There will be twists and turns. It'll be a wonderful story. There'll be great books written about it. I don't think that publisher web traffic is going to spike. So we haven't modeled in our various models, we haven't modeled a huge spike into it. We've modeled a slight increase. We do know that it's going to be terrible for advertising, right? So we have a lot of advertisers who essentially say they want to go dark from September through November. They don't want to be associated. They know we run a lot of political content. They don't want to be running any advertisements around what they assume will be a highly toxic, highly divisive election. So we are going to, we have forecast a substantial decline in advertising. Then there's the question of whether there'll be an increase in subscriptions. And my guess is probably, you know, our political coverage is fantastic. We ran some of the best stories about the 2020 election. We put together a fantastic January, February issue about the about what could happen in a Trump presidency that drove a lot of subscriptions. So I would imagine that what you're going to see in the sort of the last or in Q3 would be an increase in subscriptions, decline in advertising, and a less of an increase in readership than most people expect or model in. And I don't think that's the worst thing. I think that one of the traps for the media industry during the 2016 election, the Trump years, 2020 election, was focusing too much on that, kind of tuning their political coverage very intently on that, and then, you know, bringing in a readership or maybe getting subscribers who wanted a kind of political coverage that one couldn't sustain forever.
Interesting. We'll have to see, but I mean, that all makes total sense to me. And then I also wanted to touch on AI, because I think I saw you talk about this at the IMAR conference in New York last year. You chatted about AI a bit. Yeah. Obviously, that a whole year's gone by. A lot of people have tried things out or not tried things out and stepped away from it a bit. Are you doing much with generative AI? Is it making any tangible difference to the business in any way, whether on the back end or not?
It's not a huge factor in the business right now. We are running a lot of experiments. We are building out tools on the business side. You know, we've just built a cool AI Chrome extension. We're working on a new way to present our stories using AI. We're going to, you know, work on revising the way our search engines work. We're working on the business side to sort of make a whole bunch of processes more efficient. I've asked everybody on the staff to experiment with it as much as possible. We're being quite cautious on the editorial side. I will say that we're getting pretty close to the point where it can be very useful. So I'm writing a book about running. And, you know, as I've gone through the process the last, you know, year and a half since ChatGPT was released, I've been testing to see what parts of the, you know, the book writing process it can make more efficient. You know, can it be a really good copy editor? Can it be a useful fact checker? And this weekend, I thought I had an interesting breakthrough where I found a pretty good way of taking all of the, you know, sections that I've written and taking, you know, combining note files and transcripts and then uploading them to Anthropic, to Claude, and asking it to, you know, pull out quotes it thought were interesting or themes that it thought were interesting or things from these long files that are, you know, years, maybe a character I've interviewed 8 times over 5 years. And I've got all these notes from conversations with her. And, you know, going through them all is pretty time consuming for a human, but going through them all is pretty easy for an AI. And you say to the AI, right, I'm trying to find the point in my interview with character X where she talks about her time in Wyoming, you know, what are the most interesting. It's an incredibly, incredibly useful tool. And so I've been working on very detailed prompts and different ways of using it. And I think I found a lot of ways that it can help me, you know, and it's like a reasonably good editor at your beck and call, that you can ask any question. You just have to, you know, it's going to lie sometimes, and you just deal with that. So I found it very helpful for me, as an individual writing something. And, you know, I think over time, as it gets better, it will be more and more useful at more and more processes.
Okay. Yeah. It feels like the past year was a lot of thinking and working out. And now maybe we'll start to see a bit more kind of results of the results from that.
Yeah, I think that's right.
So obviously we're hearing about what's working for you. Who else stands out to you as kind of doing well right now or that you're impressed by, big or small?
Well, I think that, you know, in our peer group, of course, the New York Times is the gold standard for diversifying their business, right? And figuring out a way to acquire / build other businesses that create synergies with their core news gathering operation. So I'm of course impressed with them. I'm continually impressed with the information, which I think is the one you know, one of the, I don't know if it's unfortunate or one of the interesting facts to me about the subscription economy in the US is that most of the brands that have succeeded are ones that have existed for a very long time. And whether that's because of the deep brand associations, whether it's because of the kind of content, who knows, but there are relatively few startup media companies that have had successful subscription business models. The Information is one of them. You know, I was impressed that I read a story, I believe, in the Press Gazette about the growth of the cool down, right? I mean, it is cool that new startups have been able to generate a lot of success. We've seen also another climate change newsletter, 15C, has been quite successful. Oh, and another publication that I've actually been quietly very impressed by is the Boston Globe, where, you know, it seemed like it was in a really tough spot, a really, you know, a spiral like so many local newspapers. But it, you know, again, it's hard to know without looking at the P&L and having the inside information, but it seems like they've done quite a good job in getting everything together. So lots and lots of places, lots and lots of, you know, good stories across the industry, even if, of course, there are some bad stories.
Yeah, nice. Thank you. It's really nice to highlight some kind of positive stuff going on. You mentioned obviously making sure that it's sustainable profitability. If you could just set the scene for the next year or two and how you're going to make sure that that continues on a good trajectory.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, right, as soon as we announced profitability, or as soon as people started realizing we're profitability, the requests started coming in to, you know, change the way we do things and kind of relax a little bit. And, you know, maybe, Nick, you don't need to, you know, be so tough on like approving open roles, and maybe we should hire, you know, build out our brand efforts, and maybe the paywall doesn't need to be quite so tough, and maybe we should experiment here and there. And so the first thing I have to do is to continue to be disciplined, right? Just continue to, you know, we didn't get the profitability by overspending and making a bunch of bets that were unlikely to pay off, right? We got to profitability by investing in areas where we had fairly high confidence of good returns. So continuing to do that is sort of step one. Step two is going to be figuring out how to better diversify both our economic model, but also, you know, what we produce, right? And figure out ways to diversify our demographics, diversify the offerings of our journalism. And so we are running a series of concurrent projects, and one of which we call P2, just folks on the business side trying to identify what the next product that we can produce is. We've got everybody comes up with ideas, they brainstorm them, executive team cuts it down, you know, staff builds like little working groups that go into a room for a week, come out with ideas, those get reviewed by executives. So there's a sort of a formal process for idea generation, idea approval, idea improvement. We're running, you know, a series of processes to figure out the best new ideas in AI that we can incorporate into our business. And then, of course, there's going to be the goal setting exercise, which is ongoing, and it involves work with our board, which is meeting with a board member on Friday to talk through her expectations, her goals, her sense of how we should set things. Board meetings every 3 months where we go through this. So there's like board level, there's staff level, every level of the organization is working to some degree to identify what the next strategic step for The Atlantic should be. So my role right now is maintaining discipline while moving forward the processes through which we'll figure out the next steps, or we'll figure out how to invest. And then, of course, we have to keep doing all the things that are going well. You know, we have to continue to publish a really good cadence of great stories, which, you know, thankfully we do. I have nothing to do with that, but we do it. We have to continue to be smart about that process I mentioned earlier about identifying where do you have the most leverage, right? Because you can only make so many bets on the business side. There are only about five things you can do at any time that are really focused, right? So are we going to work on this or that? What are we not going to work on? And I have this thing I think about called non-goals, which are things that you know are good, but that you're not going to do. And what's nice about having non-goals is that everything you do thus has to be more good than that thing, right? So let's say one of my non-goals is developing a video strategy for The Atlantic. I would love to have a stronger video strategy here, right? But I know that the amount of time I'd have to put in, the potential risks are pretty high. And so therefore, I'm not going to spend 1 minute during the day thinking about our video strategy. But it also means that everything I do think about, I have to process and say, okay, is this more valuable than thinking about our video strategy, right? And so at different points in the organization, I've asked everybody on the leadership team to come up with non-goals, right? Not things that other people think are good and you think are bad, but things that everybody knows are good, but that we're not going to do, so that everything that we do do is above that line. And so continuing to be disciplined in setting up processes like that and making sure that we're spending our time improving the things that need to be improved, fixing the problems that need to be fixed. And you only have so many hours in a day, only so many things you can do, doing them as best we can.
That's so true, because I think sometimes it feels like publishers see like, oh, that person's doing well with newsletters or podcasts or whatever, and then everyone tries to do the same thing. But actually, if you just prioritize what you're really good at, then that should pay off.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of temptations to, and I have, you know, fortunately, I have a lot of people. I have the most incredible group of colleagues, and I will often say, hey, wait, shouldn't we be doing this? And they'll be like, okay, maybe, Nick, but no, like if we actually have more time to spend, we should make our, you know, Facebook paid marketing more efficient.
Nick, is there anything that you wanted to highlight today that we haven't talked about?
I think we've covered a lot of the most important things. I will just say that we've had a lot of success at The Atlantic by matching the business model to the editorial model, right? We didn't say to the editors, hey, we figured out the most efficient business model. Will you guys change the way you work? We said, okay, how do they work? What do they do? What's the most efficient business model to build around that? And I think that strategies like that can work really well in media. They don't always work in media, and you need some good synchronicity across goals. And The Atlantic's business strategy, which has been very successful for us, is not likely to succeed for many other publications. It just happens to work for us at this moment. It might not even work for The Atlantic in 3 years, right? We might have changed the way we produce content, or the way people read might have changed, and we might need to pivot with that. But it works right now. And so I think the lesson in media is there are lots of different business strategies. There's lots of ways to execute them. And there are, I think, really good opportunities no matter where one is.
Thank you so much, Nick.
Well, thank you so much, Charlotte. It was really a great pleasure to talk.
Thanks for that, Charlotte. It's great to hear a sort of upbeat, positive news story. Sometimes the readers complain, don't they? They say there's sort of, you know, too much doom and gloom in Press Gazette.
Not our fault. We try our best.
Yeah, we wish it were otherwise, but we can't help it if people are being laid off left, right and centre. But yeah, a good sort of success story. I suppose with these sort of things, you often wonder, you know, is it a singular thing, or, you know, is it something that can be replicated, and is it something that other publishers can learn from? I mean, what do you think? What do you think are the things that maybe can be applied maybe in different titles, different markets?
So to me, there are two key things that I think people could learn from. One is what he said right at the end. I'm glad that he managed to get it in, which is about how they matched the business model to the editorial model. So he is acknowledging that it wouldn't work for everyone. This happened to work for The Atlantic's kind of long read, focused, slower journalism, and other stuff will work better for other people. But even within that, I think he says things that are useful to other people of other business models. For example, and this is my second key takeaway, the point about how you need both those revenue and subscriber targets, if indeed that's the route you're going down. Because as he said, if you just wanted to get to 1 million subscriptions, you could do that relatively easily with all sorts of discounting and offers and almost bribing people in. But if they're just going to leave, then, you know, what's the point? And you're just saying goodbye to good potential subscribers for no reason. But if you're going to make it a sustainable business, which is now obviously what they're talking about, how they go about doing that and continuing to stay in profit rather than it being a blip, then it's about thinking what decisions will be profitable rather than just what will drive the most revenue for the sake of it, or the most subscribers for the sake of it. So I think that's a really useful lesson. Like, even the way that they do ad sales, as Nick discussed, how do you get the most profit on every deal rather than just how do you get the most revenue in, but then it's not going to be as long-term profitable and sustainable.
Yeah, don't forget the bottom line in all things.
There's one thing that matters. It's the bottom line.
I suspect there can be not always, slightly left of centre publications maybe aren't always the best at doing that. Yeah, clearly it's really influential. I was speaking to the team at Prospect, which are, I bet they'd love to have that sort of success, but they're similarly, they're sort of monthly magazine with a website and a similar sort of model. And they're clearly sort of aiming for that same sort of thing, 2/3 reader revenue, 1/3 sort of events, sponsorship and other things. So it is possible. And I suppose in the age of AI, you know, quite hard to replicate. You know, I don't think you're ever going to get an AI that can replicate a really interesting long read from a sort of good writer. Because, and here's my two penneth, AI is always going to be a sort of amalgam of different things. It's only ever going to give you an average answer, isn't it? It might be comprehensive, but it's not going to be like, you know, reading a writer with a particular point of view.
Yeah, you're not going to get fresh, thought-provoking points of view that people haven't heard before.
Well, thanks for that, Charlotte, and thanks very much to Nicholas Thompson, the Atlantic CEO, for being our interviewee this week. There's lots more paywall strategies and some good subscription stuff in the Press Gazette website. You can also read the interview. You can also read the 2022 interview we did with him. You've been listening to The Future Media Explained with me, Press Gazette Editor-in-Chief Dominic Ponsford, UK Editor Charlotte Tobit, expertly produced by Suze Cooper. Please like us and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts, and check out the website and sign up for our email newsletters if you want to keep abreast of everything that's going on in the world of news media. Thanks very much for listening.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.